Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. In the mid-80s, journalist Linda Villarosa was determined to help fix some of the health problems facing Black Americans.
Black people lived sicker and died quicker.
At the time, she was a nutrition and fitness writer for Essence magazine. Later, she became the magazine's health editor.
And many of the problems that we had were due to illnesses and disease that were considered lifestyle diseases, such as diabetes, heart disease, stroke, asthma, things that people shouldn't be dying young of. So what I thought is, if you knew better, you did better. And I thought information and education was the only answer.
And all of the staff at Essence was invested in this idea. Linda says the editor and the writers felt a deep sense of responsibility, and they had a mantra.
And it was the idea that you are each responsible for a certain number of Black women, and you had to do your best to take care of them, to give them the information that they needed. And it was a beautiful, kind of loving way to think as a magazine editor.
So Linda wrote lots of self-help articles.
How to eat better, how to change your recipes. A favorite was put down the salt shaker, and here's ways to cook with lemon and herbs, or how to make so-called soul food with less fat, how to make desserts with less sugar. And also we did a lot on exercise, different ways to exercise that weren't totally boring or that weren't really, really difficult, where you could start as a beginner. And while I don't think there's anything wrong with any of this, it's totally right, but it just wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough because Linda says the underlying assumptions about Black health were wrong.
That it's your responsibility to fix yourself. And if all of us fix ourselves, then our health outcomes will raise. It's sort of like the idea of when the water rises, all the boats lift. But that really isn't enough.
The more Linda reported on these issues, the more she understood how racism, discrimination, and bias affect health experiences and outcomes for Black Americans. And she realized that education and personal responsibility were not going to fix this health crisis. On today's episode, a conversation with Linda Villarosa about her new book, Under the Skin, The Hidden Toll of Racism on American Lives and on the Health of Our Nation. Also, we'll meet a Black midwife in West Virginia and find out how she's making a difference for her patients, and a med student who's using TikTok to spread life-saving information. But first, more from Linda Villarosa. She started to change her thinking on health inequities in the early 1990s. You describe in the book how you meet a physician, Harold Freeman, at Harlem Hospital, and he tried to caution you against this self-help message and also pointed out that we often use race as a proxy for class or poverty. We use poverty as a proxy for race. What was his message and how did you understand it at the time when you met him?
Well, when I had met him, he had just had a really important article in the New England Journal of Medicine. And he is a cancer doctor at, you know, he was at Harlem Hospital. And the study showed that Black men in Harlem lived fewer years than men in the really impoverished country of Bangladesh. And so that was really eye-opening. But I think what happened was everyone assumed that, you know, because it was Harlem, that all the people that he was talking about were poor. I mean, that's what I assumed. Now, I don't think that. My mother lives in Harlem, so that is not a thing now. But one thing he pointed out was, it's like, look at the demographics of Harlem. It is not like Bangladesh. It is not that poor. It's the inequality of our country in general that is causing these poor health outcomes. And what he did was he showed me. So I went and spent a day shadowing him. And his patient that really stuck out for me was a Black woman who was working in, you know, lower Manhattan. She came for her appointment because she had breast pain. And when she took off her shirt to be examined, she had a huge lesion that was discolored, I mean, painful. And so the obvious question was, why didn't you come sooner? And you don't want to say it like that because it's so mean and harmful, but that was the question. And when he asked her in the most gentle way, she said she was afraid. And what I thought is she's afraid of this lump, but she had already fast-forwarded to, I was afraid that if I died, there'd be no one to take care of my son. She was a single mother. And I thought, that kind of fear, it's paralyzing. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot that because it took away the lens of, this is beyond personal responsibility if there's this huge fear going on. She was afraid of the system, even though this was a very polished, professional Black physician and kind. And also that she wasn't poor. She had health insurance. She had coverage. She had a job. But there were bigger barriers to the healthcare system and to even the fear around it than I understood.
These barriers became very personal for Linda in 1999 when her father became sick with colon cancer. He had also developed mild dementia. By then, Linda was health editor at the New York Times.
And my mother called and she said, your father is really, really ill. I didn't realize the extent of his illness. And she said, he's in the hospital. And she said, you need to get on a plane, put your New York Times business card in your pocket. I'm going to pick you up at the airport, get really dressed up in your professional gear. I was also pregnant, so I had kind of awkward professional clothes. So I got on the plane, I got off, and my mom was there, and she was dressed very professionally. And I'm like, Mom, what are we doing? And she said, your dad is in the hospital. They're treating him like an N-word. So I got that right away. We went to the hospital. He was a very well-dressed person. Like he had a master's degree in bacteriology. He was very educated, I would call him courtly. But to see him in sort of a dirty hospital gown, his hair was a mess. He had insisted on going to a veterans hospital and he was shackled to the bed with restraints. And so, you know, I leaned down and he just said, get me out of here. And my mom is very savvy. She had worked in a hospital before. So we went home. We got pictures of him before he was ill. We got his military medals. We explained to them that my dad was agitated. But if you don't restrain him, if you explain things to me, he's very educated in science. He'll understand. Plus, having us there as advocates was really important. And people stopped, you know, treating him like that. But he ended up passing away not so long after that, but I remembered that. I said, why did we have to play that so-called class and education card? Why wasn't he just getting the kind of treatment he deserved?
And why had they shackled him to the bed?
He had gotten really agitated and really upset about the treatment. And then I could see why he was upset. If that's how he was, you know, he was in a not very nice setting. He didn't understand things. He was quite ill. And so he needed to have things explained to him. And he started trying to escape. He was really upset. But once we got there and we explained, no, this isn't him. These pictures are him. But treat him more kindly. Explain things. Slow down. Don't yell at him. Because that isn't what care and treatment's about. It's not about policing someone or restraining them. It's about being kind to them and slowing down and explaining things and talking to them with respect.
As you did more and more research on these issues, a different picture emerged, which shows that a lot of the problems are baked into the system. They are part of the system. They are part of the people who are treating patients. So talk a bit about that evolution of your thinking on health disparities, where, yes, social determinants of health are important, and yes, what we do as people is important, but there's this other aspect that is about the system.
And what I've been warned when I think about this is I do not think individual healthcare providers are discriminate on purpose, I think. And it's been well documented that people don't relate as well to people who are not like them. Most physicians are white. Many that treat women are men. So they're dealing with people who aren't exactly like them and might have blind spots. Also, being a healthcare provider is super stressful, especially we found out during COVID, where there's so many questions concerned. It's scary. It's confusing. There's many unknowns. Healthcare system is fast paced. So when stress hits a healthcare professional, that's when sort of your blind spots, the old discrimination that none of us can escape, because it really is part of our system in America. And so this is something that we have to tackle and admit. And instead of saying, oh, individual patients do better, or even saying, individual doctor, you're a racist, the thing is, we have to together as a nation look at our healthcare system and look at what the experience is of people of color in the system, especially Black people.
In 2018, Linda wrote a cover story about Black maternal health and mortality for the New York Times Magazine. And her reporting really put this issue on the radar of a lot of people. Linda herself had not been aware of the extent of the disparities until a friend brought it to her attention.
I play soccer on the weekends, and there is a woman on the soccer group who had been looking into this. She's a lawyer. And she said to me, I have a story idea for you. Of course, I'm not trying to hear a story idea during my, yeah. My pleasure moment and my exercise. But she started talking, did you know that the United States is the only country where the number of women who die or almost die in childbirth is going up, the only wealthy country? I was like, well, why? Is it because extremely poor women? What's happening? Is it in one area? And she said, well, actually, a Black woman is 3 to 4 times more likely to die or almost die than a white woman. I was like, oof. And then she said, but education isn't protective. And she said, a Black woman with a master's degree is more likely to perish during childbirth and the time after than a white woman with an 8th grade education. And then she turned to me and she said, don't you have a master's degree? And I thought, oh my God, I didn't know this.
So Linda decided to check into this. Her reporting took her to New Orleans, where she followed a Black woman named Simone Landrum. A little over a year earlier, Simone had been expecting a baby girl, but
she lost that baby and she almost died herself. So the baby was born stillborn and she was almost bled out. She was so ill, she passed out.
Simone had been getting really bad headaches during the last part of her pregnancy.
She also looked at her Instagram page and she thought her face was really swollen. So really bad headaches and, kind of swelling that way. 0.2 high blood pressure during your pregnancy. And so that was a thing she herself pointed out and she was ignored. She kept saying, why am I having these headaches? And they said, just take Tylenol. And then she said again, why am I still having these headaches? This is scary. What's going on? And then they said, just take more Tylenol. And clearly when she had the baby, she did have preeclampsia. She was bleeding. And that's why she lost the baby. Simone and I went back to the hospital and got her medical records and looked at it. And somebody had written in during one of her appointments, her blood pressure reading was extremely high. But the doctor, no one did anything to address it, although they made the notation. So I said, this is not your fault, Simone. This is not you, that reason you lost your baby. You did not get proper care. When I met her, she was pregnant again, but this time she didn't want to be alone and she wanted to have more support with her during labor and delivery. So she was working with Latona Giwa, who was a doula in New Orleans, who worked with people who couldn't always afford to pay. So we thought that everything would be really good this time. We changed hospitals. It was a different doctor.
Linda traveled to New Orleans to be there for the birth. So she was in the delivery room with Simone. The doula was there to provide emotional and physical support. And still, Linda says she was shocked by what she witnessed.
I would never allow that kind of treatment for a loved one or family member. I was surprised at how she was treated. Thank God the doula was there sort of guiding, you know, and pushing back against how she was treated. And so I rewrote the story to make her labor, which turned out good. Her son is totally healthy. But I made that labor sort of the center of the piece because I was so surprised to see it firsthand that way. And one of the things that really struck me was she, the baby she had lost the year before, she had named that baby Harmony. And she, you know, she was very sad to lose that daughter. So when she was pregnant the second time, when I was there, the nurses and medical students kept calling the baby the demise. So when they'd say, have you had children before? And she said, I have two sons and I also had a stillbirth. And then they'd say to her, when was the demise? And I could see her and Latona could see her getting more and more and more agitated each time they said that. It was Latona who took the staff aside and said, this is a serious near crisis right now. So please don't keep referring back in that disrespectful way to a baby she loved and lost as a demise.
And how was the doula able to calm her down when Simone was becoming very upset and the medical providers kept asking her about the stillbirth and here she is very scared, very agitated? What did the doula do to calm her back down?
Latona is a very calming person. Her voice is very even. She just had her breathe. We had put pictures of butterflies around the room and sort of self-help sayings that are very calming. We had lavender lotion that she was rubbing on her hands and arms. And she was just really focused on her and speaking in kind of low tones and saying, you know, let's get calm. What calms you? Let's just think positive. It was really beautiful. I wasn't so calm. I was staring at the monitor, watching it go all over the place. I was kind of scared. But having Latona there as a grounding force was really the thing that made the difference.
That's journalist and author Linda Villarosa. Her new book is Under the Skin. Many experts believe that having more Black healthcare workers makes a real difference for Black mothers and babies. Crystal Good looked into this issue in West Virginia, and she explored what options Black families have for finding birth workers who look like them.
When I was giving birth to my second child in 1999, I had a Black doula by my side, Pia Long. Before I met her, I didn't know what a doula was, much less that as a Black woman, her presence could increase my odds of having a successful birth. I just thought, to have a baby, you go to the hospital. But Pia told me there was another way. She told me the history of Black doulas and the traditional folk medicines practiced by Black women for years. At the time, Pia was the only Black doula in West Virginia. And since then, like so many of my West Virginia friends, she and her family left. When you're the only Black anything in West Virginia, you carry a weight. If I leave, who is going to take up this work? But another Black woman began her journey to be by the side of Black mothers and to become a certified nurse midwife, Stacia Quintrell.
I provide care to make sure that the person is healthy who's carrying the baby, and then go to their house when it's time for them to have their baby and make sure that the baby and the person having it is healthy, and then assist with the birth and stay about 4 hours afterwards. And really, it's just to govern over and to oversee that it's progressing normally.
Research has found that having midwives involved in childbirth improves outcome for both mothers and babies. But for Black women, better outcomes is not just as simple as more midwives.
A lot of these midwives have hidden biases or are actively racist, and that midwifery doesn't protect them. It is having providers that look like them that are culturally competent.
Stacia recalls one birth in 2021 where she noticed an important sign that a mom was not doing well, one that the other providers missed. I spoke to that patient. Her name is Carmen Squires. When she thought her labor was starting, she called Stacia.
I think I'm having some contractions. And I said, I'm going to go get in the shower. She said, yeah, do that. Go get in the shower. And if they stop, then, you know, we can kind of see what happens from there. But when I got out of the shower, it was more intense. I'm like, yeah, that was reverse. I don't think that was supposed to do that.
Stacia dropped everything and started the 2-hour journey to Carmen's house. During the delivery, a complication came up.
I had gotten pale a little bit, but Stacia was like, you need to drink some juice and lay back. She's pale. And another midwife said, is she really?
None of the white healthcare providers in the room recognized that Carmen was going pale. This complication let Carmen know she made the right decision to work with a midwife that looked like her. Carmen trusted Stacia, and Stacia knew there wasn't time for second guessing.
She was pale, but nobody noticed. It's hard to tell if you're not used to looking at somebody with brown skin when they become pale. When we're looking at medical training or nursing training, it's not done on all different types of skin. The base level is usually white skin, and things look very much different on white skin. That's rashes, that's bruises, that's lesions, that's all types of stuff. And being pale is one of those things.
And for Stacia, being culturally competent doesn't just mean attending diversity training. It means being brought up in that culture. It means providing Black families with a Black midwife.
You hear a lot of like, oh, you know, well, we're doing anti-racism trainings and we're doing this and we're doing this. And so they think that they have become competent in these things. And so you start to get into this almost white saviorism. And white saviorism to me is almost as bad as racism. Because you start off like, oh my gosh, they need me, I have to be here. And then because you don't understand the culture, it turns into resentment.
I talked about this with Lori Andrus. She's a researcher and associate dean for equity, inclusion, and community engagement at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Lori studied racial disparities in infant mortality in West Virginia. Black infants die at almost twice the rate of white infants in the state. And she says healthcare institutions have gotten invested in a bad strategy.
Being colorblind.
Instead of paying attention to diversity among the people who provide healthcare.
We know that if our population is made up of 30% African Americans, but we're hiring or allowing into our institutions those African Americans at a rate of less than 2% every year, then that's a disproportionate kind of entry.
Lori says not having nearly enough Black medical providers creates all sorts of issues. Everything from inequality in health outcomes to miscommunication to not taking the pain of Black women seriously. Lori says too often, we tend to blame oppressed groups for unequal outcomes.
What we know in the United States, more likely than not, that disease category is socially patterned or it's going to be broken down by race. And so the results will say those at risk for that disease are minorities, African Americans, the elderly, those who live below the poverty line. And so we've begun to associate Blackness with illness, Blackness with a greater rate of death. But what we haven't done is to look at the reasons why Black people would suffer at a greater rate with these different kinds of illnesses.
Having a provider who looks like you, understands you, makes a difference. Luckily for me, I had Pia when I was giving birth. And luckily for Carmen, she had Stacia.
The connection that I felt with Stacia is the reason why I stayed with the home birth. In the midst of us deciding that we were going to do home birth, there was a part of me that was like, Carmen, you're in West Virginia. I don't know, but Stacia would send me information, check on me all the time, and it was just convenient, smooth, amazing. Like, it was great.
Carmen delivered a healthy baby, Olivia Cannon, born on Juneteenth of 2021.
I just knew that she was going to be born on Juneteenth, and I kept telling the other midwife, I'm like, she's going to be born on Juneteenth. She's going to be born on Juneteenth.
Baby Olivia was one of the last babies Stacia needed to help deliver to become a fully licensed, certified professional midwife. Carmen had three babies in hospitals before her home birth experience with Stacia, and she says she can't even compare the experiences. Most of all, she was thankful that she could find a Black birth worker to be there through everything. And now, with the birth of Olivia Cannon, other Black families across West Virginia will have that same option.
That was Crystal Good reporting. She's the founder and publisher of Black by God, the West Virginian. It's a news organization centering Black voices in the state. Kyle Voss helped produce that story.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Journalist Linda Villarosa has covered Black maternal health extensively, and she writes about it in her new book, Under the Skin. She told me that while the numbers on Black maternal deaths are shocking enough, the statistics on near misses are also concerning.
So for every woman who dies in childbirth every year in America, something like 80 to 100 almost die. So 80 to 100 for every one that dies is really scary. And also, it means that so many, many births are not easy, are not smooth, are scary, and turn into near-death experiences. And because this is much 3 to 4 times more likely to happen in Black American women, it turns far too many births into crises.
You describe in the book how you presented your findings from your reporting to a group of Midwestern OBGYNs. What was their reaction?
I was really shocked at the reaction. They invited me to their grand rounds, and it was 12 doctors and me. And so they said they had read the story first, and the story's very data-driven. It's not my opinion on anything. Mm-hmm. It's just like, here's the study, here's the issue, here are the facts, here's the data. And right away, they started arguing with me. They said, this doesn't happen in our hospital because they had a large refugee population. The African women come in and they have a certain kinship that African American women don't have. I was like, what are you talking about? That is not true. And then they started saying, well, it's only an issue of poverty. If everyone has healthcare. I was like, no, it isn't just poverty. And then it was kind of like every point in my story, they push back against. And I was so upset. Finally, at the end, I said, here's what I see. There are 13 people in this room, and you've said that your hospital is a place where you treat a lot of Black women. Out of the 13, only one of us in the whole room is Black, and that's me, and I don't work here. I felt years going off my life because I was so angry and, you know, holding it in. But I just thought, they have a blind spot here. Even when I gave them the article, which is super data-driven, very well-resourced and researched, they still couldn't see it in their own experience.
And what do you think is the emotion behind that pushing back? Because it's a hard truth to face, and it's a very awful thing to look straight into the face of.
I think that, especially me, I'm not a physician. And so they felt like, and certainly this has been my experience with doctors especially, that I'm calling them racist, that they have gone through so much education. They work really hard. OBGYNs don't get a lot of sleep. And so I think that they thought I was saying, you're racist. And I don't think that at all. I have great respect for physicians and other healthcare providers, but I do think there's something in our system, in our country, where we don't really examine, it's very difficult to examine racial disparities and discrimination. And the system is the way it's set up and, you know, the history of it, our healthcare system is just unequal.
In the book, you describe a lot of the history of medicine, which there are many ugly and terrible chapters of Black patients being mistreated, abused, used in experiments against their will or without their knowledge. I mean, the list just goes on endlessly, and it's not in the distant past either. A lot of them are in the relatively recent past. What are some of the just wrong understandings, the myths, the false facts that have carried into medical training today that perhaps physicians still assume somehow are true?
I think the one that really hit me was about pain tolerance. Mm-hmm. So I was a contributor to the 1619 Project. So I looked at the history of the false idea that Black people have a kind of super tolerance or superhuman tolerance to pain. And that was a myth that started during enslavement. And it supported the idea that torturing, beating, working people hard in the fields, taking their children away from them, all kinds of cruelty didn't hurt Black people as bad because we had a really resistance to pain, both physical pain and sadly emotional pain. So I brought that to the present and I use the 2016 study. It was out of the University of Virginia and it looked at medical students at the time. And it gave them a list of false ideas that Black skin is thicker than white skin, that Black people have a higher pain tolerance, and just a bunch of different myths. And the white medical students, something like 40% of them believed one of the myths. And I actually more recently looked at a similar study on pain tolerance. I think this was out of the University of North Carolina, and it looked at pain management during a C-section. And so Black women were less likely, even when pain was equal in the way they complained about pain, to receive adequate pain medication. And so if this is still going on, if this is happening during a C-section, which is it's surgery, then something is wrong in the system, and it is beyond individuals being cruel. It is some kind of blind spot.
You also point to studies on amputations following issues with diabetes or issues with cancer, and those studies found that with Black patients, amputations were more likely. So there's a lot of research that seems to point out that physicians put less of a value on a Black life.
And I don't think it's in the consciousness, you know? It's not something doing on purpose. And it was that study of amputation that really struck a chord because it was among 483 other studies about unequal treatment for Black people and people of color. But that was the one that really stuck out because it said, health insurance coverage was equal. It was for people with diabetes, patients with diabetes. And even the level, the severity of the diabetes was equal. But Black people still were more likely to get an amputation. So even though I don't believe individual healthcare providers are responsible for the disparities in the system, somebody made a decision to cut off a Black person's leg or foot. And that's alarming. And so why would it be more common in Black people if everything was equal? So that's what, you know, points to an inequality that is more than just on the surface.
And when this data is presented to health systems, what is the reaction?
I think that when it's presented, people act surprised, and then it's, we'll do better briefly. And then it sort of goes back to business as usual, partially because changing the society itself and changing health systems is difficult. And so I think people are outraged. I think people try to do better. We have meetings, we have conferences. But at some point, there has to be a very large systemic change in, you know, both our culture, which I think we're grappling with now, and also in the healthcare system, which certainly over the past 2 years, I have seen changes that make me excited and that seem to spark a bit of hope.
Linda says the differences in outcomes for Black Americans during the pandemic have led to more frank discussions about these issues.
I have seen organizations, agencies, certainly colleges and medical schools really lean into this idea of racial health disparities, lean away from the personal responsibility lens and frame, and look at the structure, institutional and historical reasons why there are racial health disparities that really show up when there's a crisis. And I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, I was on a panel and it was about maternal mortality. And we were calling it something like race discrimination and, you know, maternal health. And then one of the people on the panel said, why don't we just call it racism? And I was like, wow, that just seems kind of hostile. It's too harsh. But by the end, we decided, let's just call it what it is. Let's not be afraid of this. And now I see that discussion at, you know, in the places that provide health, study health, create health policy, it's much more open. There's much more of an acceptance of this, and there's much more effort to make it better.
You have covered these topics now for many, many years. And it can feel disheartening sometimes to see the same issues. And sometimes it feels like we haven't really moved the needle at all. So are you seeing any signs of things changing?
One of the most exciting signs of hope and pointing to the future is the idea that medical students have gotten really excited about learning about racial health disparities, learning about discrimination in the system, and not bringing it forward in their own practices. So I think there's been a groundswell among medical students and other students who are studying to be healthcare providers to do something different.
Linda Villarosa is a journalist and the author of Under the Skin, The Hidden Toll of Racism on American Lives and on the Health of Our Nation. Linda just mentioned how med students are changing healthcare. And our next story is about one physician in training who's making a difference in terms of health disparities. He's using social media to share important information. His TikToks get thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of views. And some of his fans say the information is life-saving. Xavier Lopez reports.
Unlike many of us, Lauren Bovig doesn't spend her time on TikTok just endlessly scrolling. She's there to learn things. She follows botanists, foragers, people who are into science. About a year ago, Lauren was on TikTok when she saw something that made her pause. It was a video by Joelle Burvell, a medical student wearing scrubs.
I had been watching his feed, and I had seen a post that he had made about types of skin cancer that affect people with darker skin, like people of color, specifically one that affects your foot.
But here's the thing that's important for Black communities. There's a form of melanoma called acral-lentiginous melanoma. It's one of the least common types of melanoma, but the most common in African American and Asian communities. It's typically found on the palms, on the bottom.
Lauren's mom is Black and her dad is white. Before this video, she said she never really worried much about skin cancer.
I don't typically think about getting melanoma, like it's not something that's really on my mind since I never sunburn, you know.
But the TikTok worried her. She started thinking about some marks she had noticed on her own body. She had been brushing them aside as bug bites.
And after watching it, I was like, oh, you know what, I should look at my foot. And I noticed it had gotten a more mole-like appearance. And I was like, wow, I think I may actually have this. Like, I need to get that checked out.
This is exactly what the video's creator, Joelle Burvell, has in mind when making his content. He's a medical student at Washington State University with a passion for bridging health disparities and trying to provide information that is important to Black patients.
My roommates, who are also medical students, would always tease me because they could hear me in my room talking through every single iteration of my videos that I was creating from behind closed doors.
Joelle's ongoing medical training often inspires or helps with the content he makes on TikTok.
One of the series that I did when I was in my dermatology unit was just about the differences in dermatology conditions and how darker skin is often not represented in textbooks. And so I talked about that. And I think a lot of people resonated with that were medical students or physicians or nurses who said, yeah, when I was in school, I actually did not get that education about it.
Joelle says that TikTok's algorithm is part of the reason why it attracts him as a creator.
It's a long form media that's kind of endlessly scrolling and identifies people that are in your niche. So it's really been conducive to educating people both within and outside the medical field about health disparities.
Creators on the app are often able to take advantage of the trending sounds and songs of the day to push their content out to reach wider audiences.
And I try and find ways to kind of incorporate the trends into medicine.
For this one video, Joelle used the trending audio from the song Still Don't Know My Name by Labyrinth.
Every beat, I kind of point to a different image.
Different images that show how different dermatological problems can present themselves in dark and light skin colors. By using this trending song, Joelle's video will now come across with some of the most viral videos that have used this song.
I've always been surprised by how well that does, but I think it plays into this kind of pop culture while also bringing in medicine. And so you're learning in a way that you didn't realize you would be doing. It melds naturally into an app that also you can see comedy and entertainment, but also be getting educated at the same time.
This type of cancer can be found on your palms, on the bottom of your feet, and sometimes even under your nails.
After Lauren saw Joelle's TikTok on skin cancer, she started getting worried. And eventually, she went to a dermatologist.
They took a look at it and they were like, yeah, that is a pretty suspicious looking lesion. We should send you to podiatry. And so I met with them and they decided to biopsy it. And I had a small surgery. It was a borderline lesion. It turned out to be precancerous. There was a bit of confusion for a bit where it was like, possibly it's already progressed to melanoma, but it was eventually decided that it hadn't, but it definitely needed to come out, like it was heading in that direction.
Lauren says that without TikTok, the lesion could have gotten worse, turned into cancer. She felt very grateful, and she actually contacted Joelle to tell him about it.
I reached out to him because I wanted him to know that he was having an impact, you know? Because even if you put that information into the world and you hope that people act on it, you don't necessarily think that within like a month or two, someone will actually see it and be like, that's me, like, thank you.
And she's very glad that she saw that video, that random day in her kitchen.
It must have been like a lucky circumstance just that I happened to see his video. But hopefully with more things like this getting airtime from people and more visibility, even if it's like through meme sites, you know, which many people pay attention to, these kinds of preventative care won't be so rare to people.
As for Joelle, he's just glad that his work had an actual real impact.
I think stories like that as a medical student have been incredible to know that the things that I'm learning in this moment, I can transfer over to social media, share them with audiences on a larger platform, and could potentially be life-saving for someone who never knew about something like that.
For The Pulse, I'm Xavier Lopez.
And here's another health professional making a difference, Michael Hannon. He's an associate professor of counseling at Montclair State University in New Jersey. His new book offers mental health resources for Black fathers. Michael asked his own dad, Reverend Byron Hannon, to write the foreword for the book because he's had such a big influence on him.
Some measure of any success that I have is as a result of his insights and his fathering.
Michael says one sentiment his father expressed especially resonated with him.
Our fatherhood is not an expense, but an investment. He was reminding me that any challenge, obstacle, barrier that I may experience, or anybody who might be reading this in a fathering relationship, biological or otherwise, with people in their community, that those barriers, obstacles, challenges are investments, not expenses, and that we can rightfully and in faith expect a return on that investment at whatever time. And that return may not come while we're living. It can come generations beyond us. But that really stuck out to me.
Michael's book is called Black Fathering and Mental Health. One of the issues he explores is vulnerability and how Black men and fathers can feel safe in expressing it.
Something literally as simple as I'm scared, I'm nervous. And there's a risk in sharing that because somebody may not treat it with care by saying you punk or some other kind of negative term associated with vulnerability. And so how do Black fathers, how do parents, how do Black parents create the kind of environment where their children and their family members can express their vulnerabilities in ways that are accurate and precise, and then it'd be welcomed? Yo, you have every reason to be scared. I would be scared too, right? Like, I'm thinking of a moment when my nephew, who, like me, is of small stature, he's a small guy, he's 8 years old, and he's going to football practice, and he began to cry silently. And I was like, Zai, his name is Amir. I was like, Zai, what's wrong? And he said, I'm scared. And you could tell, you could literally see in all of his body language that he did not want to say that he was scared, but he couldn't contain himself emotionally to prevent himself from crying. And so I and everybody else who was around that moment had to make a decision. Are we going to tell him, you shouldn't be scared, man up, or things like that, right? That kind of gendered stereotypical language. Or are we going to say, I would be scared too? Football's pretty competitive. And so in that moment, I think I did right, because there's been plenty of times where I haven't done right. But in that moment, I think I did right, because we were all like, it's okay to be scared. I would be scared too. And empathizing, right? Seeing the world through his eyes in that moment as an 8-year-old who's never played organized football, has got all these football pads on. He's in a new community. He don't know nobody. And him and us saying that it's okay to be scared. It's okay to cry. And then try to encourage him to believe, and you can still do it, right? Like, you can be scared and being scared or being vulnerable and confronting the task before you, so long as it's not harmful or hurtful, those don't have to be mutually exclusive.
That's Michael Hannon. His new book is called Black Fathering and Mental Health: Black Fathers' Narratives on Raising Their Children Across the Family Life Cycle. We have more of his interview with our health equity fellow Marcus Biddle on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sarah Kirsten is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.